The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have main
they
engine
are
start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Monday Space Show program. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. Quickly, we'll go through the announcements. Our toll-free number for those of you who would like to call in and talk with our guest today about commercial space, Charles Miller is our guest. That toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. Please remember to let it ring. Be patient. No call screeners over here. And we'll get to your call as soon as possible and bring you up on air as soon as possible. Also, if we do put you on hold, you will hear the Space Show live through the telephone connection. So please do kill or silence your computer audio, as the feedback will confuse all of us. You can use email if you would like, Dr. Space, DRSPACE, at thespaceshow.com. Please do remember we're copyrighted and trademarked, but we do permit everybody to download these programs and share them with people they think might have an interest in space or should benefit from the particular program. And remember, a 90-minute program is roughly 40 megabytes, so if you need to know how to send that, I use a file system called WeTransfer.com, but there's a lot of them out there that'll send it around for free, and you're welcome to do that, and we encourage you to, as they say, share the wealth. Please remember that we are copyrighted, though, and we do not want you to do written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. Please don't do any edits, for example, a private YouTube channel or even for your own website, and certainly nothing commercial with the program. We're podcasting, and you can get our RSS feed URL off of our website, both of our newsletters. We're in iTunes, Microsoft, Zune, and a host of other places around the net as well. Let me hear from you if you have any questions. We have a detailed newsletter on our website, and it is uploaded every Sunday evening. It has all of the aspects of the week's programming, the guest bio, and it's the only place you'll find a future events section for the Space Show. And then if we do have to modify our week's programming, which does happen from time to time, this website newsletter is the first place that gets modified. And then we have an email version of the newsletter, which is very, very short. It goes out early Monday morning, California time, via email. And if you want that on your subscription, please send me your email address to drspace@thespaceshow.com. And as I said, all of our programs are archived. You can listen right off of our site or easily download them. There's a store called Space Show Gear on our website up near the top. Check it out. There is a guest search tool next to the social media buttons, and here are all of our programs are listed with keywords. So if you put in a keyword to search, for example, your favorite guest or Mars or microgravity, you'll find all the programs that have dealt with that, and you can pick up the dates and then pull those programs up by dates on the Space Show search engine itself. Probably to me, the most important button is the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, and we are able to bring you the Space Show free of charge and all of our content and webinars because of your support. And we thank all of you very much who do support us and those of you who will be supporting us in the future. And do remember that if you are a federal taxpayer or a California taxpayer, you are entitled to a tax deduction given our nonprofit status. Finally, remember that the Secure World Foundation is our sponsor, and they help us out quite a bit. And we're very proud and happy to have a long-standing relationship with Secure World. They promote cooperative solutions for space security. Check out their own website because it's chock full of their reports and their work. SWFound, www.thespaceshow.org, and they also are the sponsors of our webinar series. And as I said, it's been a long-standing relationship with Secure World and a very, very good one. And we're happy to be, participating partners with them. Our guest today, it's been a while since Charles Miller has been on the Space Show. It's really great to be able to welcome Mr. Miller back. He is the president of NextGen Space LLC, which provides client-based services at the intersection of commercial space, civil space, national security space, and public policy. He's also been a consultant to NASA, DARPA, the Air Force, plus a lot of private firms. And he also works with Horizons Strategy Group, which specializes in innovative approaches to national security space. He was recently a NASA senior advisor for commercial space, where he advised senior NASA leaders on commercial space options and strategies. And he led the NASA team that evaluated emerging commercial space opportunities, where he led assessments for orbiting debris mitigation, removal, satellite servicing, commercial reusable launch vehicles, and funded Space Act agreements. He is also the co-founder of NanoRacks, which all of you know about because we've done quite a few programs about NanoRacks. He is the founder of ProSpace, which was the Citizen Space Lobby. Anyway, his bio is up on the website, and it'll, of course, be up when we archive the program. So rather than read about Charles Miller, we have him right here. Let's talk with him. And Charles, again, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you doing?
Hey, David. Thanks for having me. This is you get an award. You keep on going. I think this is a fabulous show. And I think you do people a great service.
Thank you very much. Kind of like the Ever Ready Bunny, right? That battery that keeps on going and going and going. coming up on 13 years, so it's been a while. Commercial space, well, we saw two commercial space operations yesterday work out. SpaceX had their Falcon 9 launch, and Cygnus berthed and went over to the space station. So it kind of looks like it's on fire, plus what's happening with emerging companies going to do commercial operations on the space station.
Yeah, it was a really big weekend. Two big milestones on the same day, and SpaceX and Orbital, and both of them had a great deal of risk and uncertainty with them. And from a commercial perspective, commercial advocates, it was a really big day, and commercial's on a roll. I think it's really good news, and good news for the companies involved, good news for a company I'm involved with, NanoRacks, and good news for commercial space policy and advocates overall.
Absolutely. So do you see this trend continuing and expanding? Do you see any bottlenecks coming up on the horizon for commercial space?
Oh, there's plenty of bottlenecks. There's always what's the next bottleneck you need to deal with. There's still a debate going on about, say, funded Space Act agreements among some on the Hill who are skeptical about it, but all the data is lining up that they work, and they don't have much argument on their side that for using them. And unfortunately, it looks like commercial crew is going to be forced to go with the next phase for is a contract. For the completing the commercial crew systems, but at least they've gotten through most of the early phases of development using funded Space Act agreements. And I think we're much further along because of that, because they're much more cost effective. And our analysis that when I was at NASA, we conducted an analysis showed that it was on the order, depending on how you did the assumptions, from 4-to-1 to 10-to-1 bang for the buck if you use funded Space Act agreements versus using traditional procurement and development methods.
So why is anyone still supporting the traditional when the evidence is so clearly pointing to Space Act agreements?
Oh, it's hard for me. I'm not one of those. You'd have to ask those people what basis they're still supporting it, considering that America has four new launch vehicles based on using other transactions authority, which is what funded Space Act agreements are. We have the Atlas V, the Delta IV, the Falcon SpaceX Falcon 9 as well as the Falcon 1 and the orbital Taurus launch vehicle, four in a row. That is an amazing success rate considering the track record of failures we've had for traditional, cost-plus, contract-based procurement for developing new high-risk projects in the Cosgrove. You all know the horror stories, but I just, this is a success story for America. In all those cases, the companies involved put real skin in the game. They had real incentives to be, keep the cost down and to succeed. They were paid. They were getting success-based milestones, and if it was failing, it was coming out of their hide. And it proves that American innovation, whether you're a small company, innovative entrepreneurial company, relatively like SpaceX, or semi-small company like Orbital, or whether you're one of the big guys, Boeing or Lockheed, you work for them all. I think it's a wonderful procurement method. The problem is it's the people who might get it. Get the jobs under a traditional approach don't have as much work. So some people, have less work to do, and so some bureaucracies are gored, and so that's probably the source of it. But it's hard to argue against success.
Absolutely. So what do you see going forward? Yesterday, Pat Hines in New Mexico was the guest on the show, and she was talking about the need to extend the life of the station and that commercial activity on the station was only really beginning, and God knows where it'll be in 5 years from now.
I think commercial space is just starting to take off on the space station. A company I'm involved with, I was the co-founder of, as you mentioned, David, with Nanorax, delivered 9 more payloads to the space station yesterday on Cygnus. We have a whole bunch more payloads going up the next Cygnus launch. I think we're going to probably have a world record of to announce at that mission. Don't want to talk too much about it, but huge, growth for Nanorax. Nanorax is in a still very small, but in a very high growth phase. I think we're over 100 payloads now to date. We're going down and tracking down that data to make sure. Delivered to the space station. We returned 12 payloads from space, and we're putting real skin in the game. A lot of these things are self-funded. We have a whole bunch of stuff going at the space station. We're starting to put small sats out the airlock of the space station, seeing a much more customer demand. We're, NanoSatisfy went up on the HTV last month. We're getting ready to put them out the airlock here in the near future. A bunch of other companies that we're working with for launching nano satellites, and we can launch much larger satellites out the airlock. We can get satellites that are in the neighborhood of over 100 kilograms out the airlock. They just have to have some unique requirements. You have to have a safe, non-toxic propulsion. And you're in a 51.6 degree orbit instead of, you just have to be satisfied with that. So, but some really, and we see some really exciting microgravity things. Nanorax, if they weren't on recently, has a whole new method for doing protein crystal growth. The previous protein crystal growth experiments were non-standard with what was done on the ground. And so the crystals that were grown in space were hard to compare from a scientific basis for what was grown on the ground. And so we went to a company called Emerald Bio and said, why don't we take this standard protein crystal growth technology and put it in space? But everybody said, it won't work. So we said, well, okay, why don't we try it? So we did out of our own pocket. Flew the Emerald Bio protein crystal growth system that many researchers use here on Earth. We flew it to space, and it worked. We got 100 crystals out of it. And, those who had said it couldn't be done and wouldn't work were wrong, and we put our own money into it.
You already have a question. This is from Peter, who's in San Antonio, Texas, by email. And he said, Charles, the government organization CASES is designed to help facilitate commercial work on the station. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I think it's important that the nation has something like CASES. They've got off to a slow start. They had a bunch of infighting going on about how they would be structured. I think they're now on their feet. CASES is a customer of NANORAC. I think they do have a difficult road to hoe, that they've been asked to do two different things that are much different than each other, and they're doing their best to try to accomplish those tasks. And those tasks are, one, they're supposed to act as a national lab for partnerships based on fundamental science, like working with NSF and researchers,
right,
which is fundamental basic research. And the other task that is much different is they're supposed to try to figure out how to be a good partner with commercial industry. And those are they used completely different methods and processes and thinking and values for those two different communities. And they're going to try to do both. So I think that'll be a struggle for them. But we're working with them. We're helping them on some things. We preceded the creation of CASES and have a Space Act agreement with NASA. And I think from a national perspective, CASES is significantly underfunded. They have a $15 million a year budget, but it's really difficult because of the last couple years the argument to the Hill and the White House to give CASES a lot more money. There's not a lot of goodwill there. At least I don't think they're talking about ending CASES anymore, but it's not a good foundation to stand on to go say, hey, you should put more money into actually utilizing the space station, give CASES more money. And it's a tragedy because we spend $3 billion a year operating a station, and we don't spend very much money on utilizing.
Well, doesn't CASES help create wealth for companies as well as the nation?
Yes, they are, but they just got their first payload to the station on Cygnus at the first let yesterday with the
berthing. Yeah, it just seems to me it'd be a no-brainer, but that's probably why I'm not qualified to be in Congress.
Well, it's a no-brainer that if you're going to spend $3 billion, if you're going to spend upwards of everything costed, including the launches, $100 billion to build a space station. And then you're going to spend $3 billion a year on operating it, and you say, well, the primary national lab managing the national lab portion of the space station, you're going to give them $15 million with an M for using it? Something's wrong.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
And unfortunately, CASES doesn't have very much goodwill inside Washington, D.C., and that's unfortunate because we're spending $15 million, every couple days on CASES.
Well,
on station operating.
I have made several efforts to do a show with people from CASES, and I can't even get a reply email from them, and that's with people helping introduce me to people. So
that's too bad. They got a new executive director. Maybe you get a different response.
Who is the new director?
Well, he was an astronaut, and he was hired recently, and they've been trying to hire an executive director here for a long time. I suggest try to get that astronaut on board. I don't know the gentleman, but that maybe they were. I just think maybe they're so wrapped up in that they couldn't get anybody out. So So
well, I'll try again because they'd get a lot of support and publicity off the space show audience that probably doesn't know about them. So,
right.
So tell us what NextGen Space LLC is doing.
Well, NextGen Space is focused on a really hard problem, which is if commercial space folks and commercial industry think a lot different than civil space, and civil space folks think a lot different from commercial space, and they think differently from public policy folks, and who think differently than national security space folks. And so at the intersection of that, a lot of people think, well, it's obvious these people should be sharing resources or working together, or you should have public policy helping commercial space or civil space so unless you've kind of lived on both sides and worked the issues for a while, it's hard to, at the intersection, solutions. The most difficult and practical problems in national space policy are at that intersection. And most of the people who work in this field kind of specialize in one or the other, but not at the intersection. So our focus is on solving problems at the intersection. So most of my expertise is actually in commercial space and public policy, but I spent 3 years at NASA, and now I have spent, you know, upwards of 10 years, or probably more, 6 or 7 years, working with NASA as because we were an alternate access station winner and were focused on COTS for many years. So I have a much deeper appreciation of the way NASA folks think and what's driving them. And so I now provide that as a consulting service to help big companies who want to know, be more commercial-like or partner with commercial space, or commercial space companies who want to know how NASA works. And I have NASA. NASA's a client to help them. They need help with commercial space. So one of my first clients coming out, when I left NASA, I did a 3-year tour as a NASA-accepted service in the DoD called term appointment. They called me up and said, please help. We need your help with commercial space policies and strategies. So NASA is one of my clients. I have Nanorax is one of my clients, and other commercial companies, you know, who are my clients.
So is that demand for solving problems at the intersections, is that increasing? Is that rising as more and more players come into being and this becomes more crucial?
Yeah, I think it's rising. As commercial space is ascending and becoming more credible, I think people want to understand how commercial space works, and commercial space, you know, wants to understand how big aerospace companies, you know, there's partnerships, or how NASA works, or NOAA, or DARPA works. And so DARPA just announced, we could spend some time talking about it here later, a mission called XS-1, which is Jeff Bonnell is the program manager out of DARPA for a Mach 10 suborbital ROV, which is the goal is 10-10-10, and they want to fly 10 times in 10 days to Mach 10, and it's supposed to be a reusable first stage for a hybrid launch vehicle that can put, payloads in the space at much lower cost. And they want to transition it. I listened to the DARPA director last week talk about this. Her strategy that she, was very clear on, is it's difficult to transition this technology to the Air Force. Her strategy is to do like DARPA did with semiconductors and transition it to industry, and then Air Force and national security customers can be a customer of commercial industry who will operate this much lower cost commercial launch vehicle. So I thought that was very visionary of the DARPA director, that's part of the intersection here. How do you make that happen?
Here's another email question from you. Sarah's in Boston, and she says, Charles, are you seeing an influx of foreign commercial potential deals or ventures given the success of America's commercial industry? I think we're the only country that really has a dynamic, emerging, and successful commercial space industry.
On influx, I don't know if there's always some that are on the table. In fact, CSI, one of my prior companies, Constellation Services International, we were a U.S. company owned and controlled, but we were partnered with RSC Energia. We had that partnership going back to like 1999 when Boris Yeltsin was president, and I lived through the transition where Putin became president, and it was politically correct at one point and then politically incorrect at a different point. And Nanorax works with Astrium, European company, and we also work with the Japanese, the JAXA. So the International Space Station, there's a natural international partnership. So I do international partnerships have a lot of experience in that. But I wouldn't say there's it's any greater now than it was at any other time. I think there always are there, and part of being a commercial space is naturally an international business, and anybody worth their salt as a commercial space executive needs to understand that and think about that, and in the right circumstances, partner with an international firm.
Given the success of what is showing up in our commercial industry, I kind of wonder why other countries don't sort of establish some kind of a commercial part of the industry.
But it's a cultural thing.
Yeah, I was going to say, I guess it's cultural.
Why don't they establish an industry that does kind of like Facebook and semiconductors? And they try at times, but China's trying now to, set up, cell phone companies and other all bunch of companies to compete with the American entrepreneurial companies. But it's really our culture of innovation and the entire ecosystem of supporting startups that is doing it. There's companies in Europe that are trying to stand up reusable suborbital companies, but you go ask them how much money they need, and they want $1 billion to do a Mach 3 or Mach 4 suborbital ROV, and I think, they're waiting for some government to fund them, and it just looks like to me, and I don't think they get the concept. And, Virgin Galactic is here in America for a reason. Richard Branson understands that the innovation, the culture here for building a commercial suborbital ROV, he needs to do it in America. And I think that a lot of the opportunities that American entrepreneurs see in space is some smart, international firms, want to work with Americans. Companies. So X-Corp is working with a variety of investors. Tesla Aerospace got a lot of their financing from overseas, from Hong Kong and the Middle East. And, just like in Virgin, now working with the Scale Composites, getting a big chunk of money from the Middle East, too. So I think there's the people who overseas, there's a lot of interest in doing commercial space projects, but the ones that I think go somewhere are the ones who, reach out somehow to the cut deals of the American company.
Here's another email question for you. And listeners, if you're not at work, you have access to the phone. The toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Carl is in Spokane. And he says, is there anything exciting and equivalent on the human spaceflight side for commercial?
Oh, I am really excited by the potential of commercial crew, done right. And I think there's the whole question is whether we're going to open up large new markets for commercial spaceflight to do that. And there's been lots of... surveys on it, and I don't think the surveys can even scratch the surface of the real issue. If you think about it this way, and why I'm excited. So we've had, while there was access to commercial flights to go to the space station, there was basically one flight a year sold to the space station, and that was really limited what you could get. They were sending, the swaps of crew that you go up where one crew's going up, the other's coming down, and you had a seat. And the Russians sold the first one for well under 15. The price was near 12 to Dennis Tito. But over time, the price actually went up, and it went up to nearly $40 million, and one person did it twice. And so it shows there is a significant demand for that. Billionaires really don't care about the 16 or 20 or 30 or $40 million. You think about it from their perspective, the biggest price for them was taking 6 months out of their life to go to Russia and learn Russian and being away from their family. And the rest was pocket change. They're just taking a little bit less money with them, given to their heirs or to some foundation at the end of the day. They got to enjoy it. I think once we get anything at that price point and launching from the United States, where you don't have to learn Russian, you don't have to be away from your family for 6 months, and maybe you get a month of training, and then you can go to take a trip to space, and maybe it's $10, $15, $20 million, I think there's a much larger market. and than we've seen. And it's totally changes the value proposition for there's several thousand billionaires across the planet, many larger, a much larger number of centimillionaires, and they, it's by all accounts a fabulous experience, unique experience, and I think a lot of them are going to buy in. And then once we start getting reusable launch vehicles and start driving the cost even down further, or semi-reusable launch vehicles, the market's going to take off. I think there's a large demand for it. The biggest issue has been the risk of the investment to getting a reliable, low-cost human spaceflight system. So I think it's critical that commercial crew be structured in such a way that it doesn't drive the price through the roof, because we could structure a commercial crew in a way that it's an $80 million seat trip instead of a $20 or $30 million seat. And, I don't think there's much of a market at $80 million a seat. There's much more market in the $10 to $20, $30 million a seat. And these vehicles are talking about taking seven people. So you could do a SpaceX commercial crew system with six seats at $25 million a seat, and that's $150 million of revenue, right? So I think there's a... And then you'll see the price coming down as you get the maybe a reusable Falcon 9 this XS-1 technology that DARPA could develop, and we could see prices get down in the single-digit millions per seat in the not-too-distant future. And then the market dynamics takes off, and the market grows, and we get what we all wanted, which is what we haven't had, where the market starts driving, the commercial market starts driving the growth of the industry.
Here's another email question from you, and Alex is in, Salt Lake City. And Alex says, do you foresee the Bigelow space stations as a driver for the commercial markets and lowering price?
I think the Bigelow space station could be, in the right circumstances, a critical driver for driving markets. I think Bob Bigelow has the right market in mind at the beginning, that countries are willing to, sovereign nations are willing to spend a couple $100 million to be part of the International Space Station, and there's many more countries that were not willing to spend $200 million or so to be part of the International Space Station, but they might spend $50 million. And so a space station where they got to put their name on the module and have a real research program in orbit could be very appealing. I think it makes a lot of sense. And then the real other things that could be spinoffs is all the basic research going out the International Space Station. We get a breakthrough and you want to scale it up. Let's say you had the cure to cancer, the cure to salmonella, or some other great thing. You would really want to do it from a commercial space station. We're scaling it much larger. Bigelow would be much more service oriented, and I think it was really, good news that Bigelow partnered with NASA to add a stowage module on the space station. In my opinion, that puts the NASA brand on the Bigelow that is good enough for putting up the International Space Station. So I think it helps when they take the next step eventually to building a commercial space station.
What about the suborbital part of the industry? How does that fit in, or is it separate but thriving?
Well, the original theory, which still hasn't been proven wrong, was that you start with suborbital, generate real markets for customers and demand for doing a commercial human space flight in the much higher price point. You start with suborbital, say maybe Mach 3 or 4. Reusable launch vehicle, then you might take them a little higher, faster. You might be in a position with companies growing to build a Mach 10 reusable launch vehicle and then pop some things into space with a hybrid, with a reusable first stage, expendable second stage. And then eventually, with the economics keep on driving you, you can eventually get all the way to orbit. You're developing engineers with the expertise and knowledge, and you keep on inserting advanced technology into it, and you let you know, market forces work. You get teams of engineers and our best and brightest working on that, and eventually you'll have enough cycles of improvements that you grow an industry that takes you to space, all the way to orbit, low-cost access.
So
I think that is the most compelling reason from a national policy to support this. And then, of course, people can get to spend their money at $100,000 or $200,000 a ticket to go. And there's some interesting science you can do, too, for 3 or 4 minutes of microgravity.
Is it a stepping stone, or is it just is it in harmony with and enhances the other, or does one eventually feed to it and suborbital sort of disappears as those companies go orbital?
Well, I don't know if it ever disappear, because you know the suborbital will always be cheaper for those who can't and probably have more flights. I think when it is a stepping stone, and the jury's out whether, you know, those going big and like Elon going all the way to orbit and then trying to backfill into a reusable system, or those who are doing reusable systems suborbitally and then trying to get to orbit is the best strategy. And I think we should try all of those. And so there's a synergy there, and competition is good for accelerating the innovation.
Another one for you. Becky is in Los Angeles. This is David. I'm at work, so I can't use the phone. Charles, since you spent 3 years at the NASA headquarters building, steeped in NASA management, can you do a sort of quick compare and contrast of how things are done NASA and government bureaucracy style versus the commercial sector?
Well, gosh, they're much different. Commercial sector is very much focused on the value proposition and speed and getting some money or doing something different. You have a business case, you either raise the money and to do the business case, you don't raise the money, you go do something different. And sometimes that means shutting down the company and getting a new job. And so it's very rapid iterations. It's you're very much bottom line, make the case or go home. With the government, you have a function you fill for the taxpayers that is more long term, and it's very much driven by the budget process. A lot of the things that the government could do would be much more efficient and the budget process is year to year. And it's very politically driven, because you have we have a representative democracy, and people are across the country are represented by different viewpoints, and it gets tied up in these debates and differences of opinion and interests from certain regions of the country who have jobs at stake, and it becomes much less efficient. But it's also, they're going to be there 1 year and then again the next year, even though they're inefficient. So it's from a public policy perspective, we just have to figure out, it's not all one or the other. There are things that industry doesn't do well that you want the government to do, like long lead, high risk research. Industry just doesn't invest in. And it comes to the bottom line that, if you look at the internal rate of investments, anything that's going to pay off beyond 5 years has essentially zero value. Well, you want, as a nation, to be investing in high-risk research. That industry isn't. And if you don't have a Bell Labs-like entity doing it, the government is quite good at that. And so you have things like DARPA and the Office of Chief Technologist, now Space Technology Mission Director, and others doing that. And there's also a legitimate function for part of the government doing things that industry, from an infrastructure perspective, just can't afford to do, like the NACA did, the National Advisory Committee in Aeronautics, built wind tunnels that no one company could afford because they just use it a little bit and then go away. Well, you need one national wind tunnel to do certain things, that's a legitimate government function to build that infrastructure and significantly accelerate, capabilities for the nation. And it helped America recapture world leadership in aviation because the government invested in the NACA, so the Lockheed and Boeings and Martins and Glenn Martins of the world and Martin Marietta's of the world could take advantage of it.
Absolutely. So it seems to me also you see companies like Boeing, probably more Boeing than some of the others, that are really making an effort to become competitive in the commercial world that we've been talking about, even though they're commercial companies anyway. Do you see that happening with more companies other than Boeing, or do you concur that Boeing is sort of the leader in that right now?
Boeing's leader in what?
In trying to compete in the commercial Space Act type of world, the emerging commercial industry, rather than just being locked into traditional aerospace types of things.
Well, I don't know if they're the leader in that. They do it. Boeing is I think, a commercial company first, and they have an aerospace and defense division that secondarily does business, that they've taken some of the technologies and capabilities they started out with, Bill Boeing in aviation. And there's always a tension between the two because the aerospace and defense part of Boeing, there's many of those people, cut their teeth on cost-plus contracts and treating the government as their only customer. But they keep on putting people who have experience in the more commercial parts of Boeing over there. So Boeing is kind of a tension there where it ebbs and flows from one time to the other. They'll put money into the Delta IV, and then they'll be handed their hat, and then they'll take a break, and then they'll put money into, say, maybe Sea Launch, and they got handed their hat again, so they were both turned out poor investments for them that they wrote off. If you go into Boeing at the wrong time, they'll say the senior manager remembers how much they lost on the project 5 years ago, and they tell you, don't let the door hit you in the behind on the way out. Then a little bit longer along, they forget about the bad story that happened before because they wasn't on their watch, and they'll may take a new look and be willing to consider something again. So it depends on which Boeing manager you're talking about, I'm trying to say. I think Sierra Nevada and SpaceX are the most exciting companies from a commercial perspective right now. They put real skin in the game. Boeing, Elon bet went all in on the last dime of his wealth a few years ago. It could have been a much different story in late 2008. He might have lost it all. There was no guarantee that Tesla could have pulled out or that SpaceX was going to succeed. And all the word was that he was within a month or two of telling people he couldn't pay him at SpaceX. And then everything turned up golden. So here in Nevada is probably the biggest untold story for commercial space. They're putting in serious big bucks into commercial space projects with Dream Chaser. And they're a kind of like third in the horse race right now with Commercial Crew. But you brought up Boeing, and I say this for a reason. The day it came out, Boeing put no skin in the game on Commercial Crew. They didn't put any. Their attitude, the people I think who started Boeing off in Commercial Crew wanted the Boeing to put money in, but they couldn't convince senior management to put real skin in the game. So the question is whether this Boeing management is serious about Commercial Crew or what they're just taking the money from NASA that NASA is willing to give. I think it's an open question.
How do you see ATK evolving in this area of putting skin in the game for commercial projects?
Well, ATK is a fascinating company. They got a bunch of people in it who really do believe in wanting to do some stuff. they bought up a bunch of companies. So some of them are, you know, like ATK Swales, the small stack company that's called Swales, that's near Goddard, who want to invest in Vivisat and commercial satellite servicing. So that they have a very entrepreneurial mindset there. And there's other parts of ATK that, you know, that are very aggressive in trying to go after commercial projects. And then there's the parts of the ATK that are much more traditional. So it's they're one of the fascinating cultural, corporate entities to watch. And they get very aggressive politically. They'll, at the drop of the hat for something that they're big strategic priorities, and then they'll invest a lot of money in hiring astronauts and government affairs people to go make their pitch. So depends on what part of the ATK you're talking about.
We're halfway through the show, so it's a good place to take our break. And listeners, we'll be back in 3 minutes. And the phone line, if you want to use it rather than the email, is again 1-866-687-7223. Back with more on Commercial Space with Charles Miller. 3 minutes, everyone.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And The Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everyone. This is the second part of our Monday Space Show program. Our guest today, Charles Miller, we're talking all aspects of commercial space. And I have an email that came in through the break, another one, from Joel in Kansas City. And he says, David, I'm also still at work, so I can't use the phone, but I am able to listen and send you an email question. Charles, you mentioned nanosats and CubeSats and SmallSats a little bit during the early part of the first segment. That market seems to be exploding, especially because of Kickstarter type of financing programs. Most of these, I guess, are commercial projects, especially given the crowdfunding kind of backing that they get. Do you have any thoughts on the constructive role that crowdfunding is starting to play, and do you think that's going to continue?
Well, I think crowdfunding is playing a very good role for particularly for those who don't have easy access to startup capital for new ideas. And I believe we have about four of at NanoRack, about four of our customers are Kickstarter funded, and for NanoSat getting launched to orbit. And of course, they want to, raise the money and then get launched in some reasonable time frame, which is what NanoRacks can do. And one of the things that NanoRacks is proud about to talk about is we've delivered over 100 payloads to orbit, I believe. And I'm saying I believe because I had a very specific number in mind, but we're now, you know, tracking down and verifying it. Our average time for delivery is from contract signing to delivery in orbit is 9 months, which we think is a really compelling, you know, thing. You know, most satellite, you know, provide, you know, manufacturers, builders are used to several years if they do, if they get a ride. And, you know, our Nanorax, you know, has an average delivery time of 9 months for the orbit.
And you have four customers that use Kickstarter to acquire their capital.
Four of our customers that use Kickstarter, at least part of the financing for their projects.
So if someone comes to you and they're partially or fully Kickstarter funded, that's not a negative in your book at all then?
Oh, we don't care. I mean, we care is like, you know what, so I there was an interesting conversation at the New Space 2013 conference, and someone got up during one of the sessions and asked, you know, I have the money, I want to go, what do I do? And they were asking about what the process, and someone answered them, well, you need to go through this competitive process, with peer review, and he says, no, I just want to go. So I actually stood up during the session and said, you call Nanorax. We don't care about you know, a peer review or what science you're doing or the, you know, about your project. We just care about that your check clears and that you're safe. You have to be safe and go through the ISS safety process, which is part of what we manage. And then there's a third requirement that only in the rare cases is an issue, which is we won't do anything that embarrasses our landlord. So, you know, girls gone wild at space station is not an option.
There's probably been worse things than that that can embarrass the landlord, no. But that's another question.
We are not going to be party to embarrassing our landlord.
I mean, the real truth is, with commercial, you know, if you want to waste your money, but you want to pay for the ride, what the hell?
Yeah,
that's your choice,
that's your
right?
Money. You know, we only need to know enough to make sure that
that you're compatible and safe.
You're not going to blow up the space station or spill some toxic fumes that could hurt the health of astronauts or, you know, that's all we care about.
So for wannabe commercial companies out there, Kickstarter is not a detriment if they fund that way to getting something going.
No, not at all. We don't you have to decide as a company whether you have a branding issue with using Kickstarter or it hurts your brand, or whether but that's for you to decide. I mean, I think it is embarrassing for a company that is seems to be credible and goes out and tries to raise money in Kickstarter and then can't raise anything. So there's a downside risk for an entrepreneurial commercial space company. So if when I have firms who are thinking about it, I advise them to think about it is, you know, if you don't do it, it's embarrassing. Okay, if you go out and do a Kickstarter project and you created all this credibility as a firm and then you can't raise the money, and you could raise almost nothing in some cases, it can be embarrassing and hurt your brand image as a firm. So that's Nanorax doesn't care about it. You come to us when you raise the money, or you're raising it, and you sign a contract and you put down a down payment.
I did a show several weeks ago with a British wannabe space tourism company, and darn it, I forget the name of the company, but they want to make 88 passenger vehicles, and I forget the name of the company. Darn it, I wish I could. But they had tried a Kickstarter, and they raised $0 for it.
Right.
So I asked them about their Kickstarter and got a good dose of spin on, we were just testing the waters, it really didn't mean anything. And I mean, you could tell that this was just, you know, a cover up for a lousy Kickstarter campaign,
right?
For whatever. And but you know, I was polite about it and let it go at that. I figure people will figure out what they want to do. But that's really only one of the few that I've seen that was really a dismal failure. They didn't raise hardly anything. But
it hurts your credibility because you get on radio talk shows with David Livingston and he asks you, what about that Kickstarter campaign that you didn't raise any money? You know, I mean, and that's a fact. You did it and, you know, you're out there with no clothes on.
That's right. And then when you spin it, that also hurts your credibility.
Yeah.
But hey, that's not my choice, whatever. Do you think that the crowdfunding, and I understand they're going to allow some kind of equity advertising through crowdfunding. That's kind of in a commentary period with the SEC and some rules going on right now. So it seems to me this is going to play a bigger and bigger role in emerging space companies. And probably I get three requests a week for space companies for me to put them on so they can tell the world about their Kickstarter programs. I mean, it's almost gone viral, or maybe it has gone viral.
Well, that's part of what you do. You need to have like marketing strategies that tie it into your Kickstarter campaign, so people hear about it, so they'll go to Kickstarter and give you money. So it's just not you go put your company on Kickstarter and free money shows up. The ones who actually succeed have it's part of a much larger marketing strategy, and where you have brand, you already have in many cases you're even getting attention and branding from some other source, from free media, and then you have a Kickstarter campaign that's an adjunct to that. So Planetary Resources, as an example of a success, had a huge amount of free media and a lot of sizzle and excitement. And then when they announced their Kickstarter campaign, it was built on a very strong foundation of excitement and sizzle and a lot of free media and brand name. And so they naturally did much better. So it has to be just one piece of a campaign.
When I introduced you and I was reading the new bio that you sent me to update on the Space Show file, you mentioned working with Horizon Strategy and innovative approaches to national security space. To the degree that you're able to talk about this, what are the commercial opportunities with national security space?
Well, gosh, there's lots of great offset. So I'm like the commercial space person on the Horizon Strategies game team. Josh Hartman, who was a very innovative strategic thinker within the Department of Defense. He was worked on the Hill. He actually wrote the legislation that became the Operationally Responsive Space Program as a started Horizon Strategies, and they just focused on innovative, low-cost strategies and approaches for a variety of clients. And often there's, you know, a commercial component or a civil space component to that, and so I'll help, Josh with that. Then this variety of things from GPS has commercial components. You know, you get TDRS, where you have a civil space component. You have small satellites that have both a national security and commercial component.
What's the commercial component of TDRS?
Well, it was more of a civil space component of TDRS, I'd say, since it's got a national security customer.
Right, I'm aware of that.
But it's managed by NASA. The commercial component of TDRS is that the follow-on TDRS in the future could be, under some people's thinking, could be commercially owned and operated. In fact, TDRS was originally a commercial partnership between Western Union, TRW, and NASA. And the first generation TDRS was done in a commercial firm fixed price contract to Western Union from NASA. They had TRW build the spacecraft, and they got all the way through CDR, and then Western Union in the early 80s said, oh, this is a really bad deal because they were losing their shirt because their requirements kept changing, and they'd signed this firm fixed price contract and didn't see any way how they were going to make money. And also their original idea for a commercial market for use of TDRS at the time wasn't showing up. They weren't signing up commercial customers for the in low Earth orbit for using the TDRS system. So they backed out, and NASA ended up contracting with TRW to continue to build the design. But, you know, the TDRS system now is much, you know, it's been flying for decades. You could maybe save the U.S. government funding by commercially procuring the follow-on systems in a different manner.
Interesting.
Using maybe, and if you need some risk reduction, you might use the COTS model for with space funded space agreements and commercial, you know, terms and conditions under the contract for the, you know, you could do a data buy. Instead of buying the satellite, the TDRS satellite, why don't you buy the service? You know, so there's options there to be looked at that people haven't looked at in 30 years.
So, okay, I was not aware of any of that, so.
Well, that's what I do. Like, it's at the intersection of, that's a perfect example of being at the intersection of civil, national security, and commercial space.
So, when you're talking national security, is there room for an emerging startup, or does national security require a long-term company with references and stability and things like that?
Oh, gosh. Well, the national security customer are generally quite conservative. It's harder to break in than even probably NASA because on top of talking, they use all the same processes and conservatism that NASA might do, but then you also have to bring any kind of security clearance to the table to really have the secret handshake and know what's going on. So I would say there are commercial startups that can do things, but they need to have people on their team that have the insight of know how a national security space operates and what they care about. You know, many of the successful examples probably would have people on their team who actually were former executives in the Defense Department or the NRO or elsewhere or in big, you know, defense aerospace companies. And so if you go look at the, you know, a good example is the commercial remote sensing industry is now dominated by Digital Globe. But if you go look at all the various companies that were set up there, they either have a big piece of that with a big aerospace company, or they would have an executive who came out of that industry, and then they'll have some really entrepreneurial types that help them out. So, I think it's part of the strategy for a commercial space venture. You want to, like they say, it's having a B business plan idea and an A management team. In this case, part of your A management team needs to be somebody really understand that part of your business.
Okay, and I have another email question for you. And this is from Jack, is in Tucson, Arizona. And Jack said, when you're looking at an emerging commercial company to play a role with anything that you're doing at the intersection, so to speak, what is the ideal management team look like?
Oh, gosh. Well, it depends on the business. It's hard to, you need to look at the keys. You know, your management team is a reflection of your strategy. And it's a tough problem because sometimes your management team puts together your strategy. But really, you need to have a management team that supports your strategy for making money and getting into business. And what are your key risks? And if you don't understand, you know, you can look at a management team, and a lot of times you'll see just reading a cursory, you know, quickly and then reading a business plan, they don't have the management team that can manage the risk, the key risks of this business. And you very quickly can say that, you know, sophisticated investors can very quickly, if they know that area, say, that these people don't have it. They don't have the right team together, and they may have a great idea. And that, in that case, investors are going to help that management team one way or another. And sometimes they'll give them a new CEO, and other investors have a different idea. They'll help train the current CEO and help them developed the expertise. So there's different philosophies on this, but I think that's, you know, what it is. You have to look to the key strategy and the key business risk, and then the management team has to line up with that.
So that's really where you kind of separate the men from the boys is when you look at the management team.
Yeah, well, you can quickly, you know, that's often a key filter is looking at the management team and seeing exactly that. Do they really understand it, who they have online, you know, and then whether you spend any more time thinking about it.
If you could look out 10 years from today, where do you see our U.S. commercial, entrepreneurial, startup type of business industry? What do you think it would look like in 10 years from today?
Oh, gosh. I see some really compelling, exciting applications going on in satellite constellations. I think we're going back to a new era where you had it in the 90s with constellations of satellites. I think NanoRacks is going to be part of affordable small sat constellations in low Earth orbit. I think you're going to see some really exciting and compelling applications of small sat constellations from civil, you know, from weather to remote sensing to communications to, there's some national security applications that are going to be really exciting. And I think it's really a very disruptive time taking place, that the people building small sats and really are innovative on it are not the big guys. You see a classic Clayton Christensen innovator's dilemma going on. The companies that started doing small sats couldn't really focus on it, and you see the people that worked on those small sats and the big companies are leaving those big companies and starting companies. And we're getting to a place where, you know, everything's in place to actually have small sats that are actually doing real science, doing real systems and services. And then they may not be, I don't think, in most cases they're not 1 U's, in a few cases they'll be 3 U's, but you're starting to see more companies looking at 6 or 12 U's. I don't think you should get fixated on the size. You have the size that makes sense. But I think that's where the most exciting thing taking place. I'm also really excited about 10 years out, commercial space tourism. You know, from commercial crew to the Virgin Galactics and X-Plorers of the world, I think there's going to be large growth on that. I think there's going to be, I don't know what it's going to be. I also think we're going to find some compelling applications from finally commercializing microgravity research at the space station. I think we're going to find some things that make a lot more sense for using microgravity. So 10 years out, that's where I think the most exciting things. And then I also think we're going to be, by that time, be much closer to low-cost access to space. These new markets and from commercial crew and tourism and utilization and the investments put in back by the country on ROVs, we're going to be intensely focused like we were back in the 90s on low-cost access to space or CATS or cheap access to space. I think that we're going to have a turning point here in the near term where we're focused on, extremely expensive systems. I think that's what happened in the mid-90s we had a focus on deficit reduction. And I think the focus on deficit reduction in the mid-90s drove the country to start focusing on cheap access to space. That was all the rage and from about 94, 95 through the end of the decade. And I think we're going to see the same thing going on here. I think that's, by the end of this decade is going to be one of the biggest things going on in the country is a refocusing on cheap access to space.
Do you see possible threats from the regulatory world as being serious or just something to take note of and to be aware of and to be vigilant about?
There's always going to be threats from the regulatory world. There's always going to be problems. I don't think that's new. There'll be some new set of bureaucracies who want to, there's some problem going on and they want to fix it using regulation. And there'll be the tension with the industry that says there's a better way to fix this than with regulation. And so And sometimes the country does stupid things. The ITAR was because of a political reaction over China, and they wanted to punish the Clinton administration. The Republican Congress in the late 90s wanted to publish the Clinton administration, so they thought they, you know, Jim Sensenbrenner passed this bill. I talked to people who used to work for him. His intention was that he was going to pass this bill to related to ITAR and to punish the Clinton administration. So, they were focused on that they let this sensitive technology go over there and take it away. So, and they also did the same thing with INCSMA, the Iran Non-Proliferation Act. They thought that the Clinton administration would veto that, and he didn't. He just, you know, sometimes the Congress miscalculates, and then we pay for it for years. And so we're finally, I think, hopefully solving ITAR, but there'll be something new, you know, near the end of this decade. It'll almost certainly be different ITAR, and no knowing what it will be.
Roger sent in a note and says, "I'm in Silicon Valley, and there is this incredible interest, and there are also incredible programs coming out on helping to mentor people into space, emerging commercial things, meetings over here at the Hacker Dojo. The Silicon Valley space community seems to be active and growing. And I understand things like this are going on in other areas where there are hotbeds of technology. I'm curious to know if you think this type of mentoring, this type of assistance is significant for the space community, or is it just something that's nice to have? How do you see it playing out?
I think it's a nice to have, but I wouldn't put it in the significant. I think the main success stories coming out of commercial space, people who made their money or got their career in doing something else, and then started a commercial space firm. A lot of them worked at, say, NASA, and some of them worked at an Intel and in Silicon Valley companies and made their money elsewhere and then go start a commercial space startup because that's where their passion is. You're there in Silicon Valley, Roger. One very good example is Planet Labs, which used to be called Cosmobia until they really went public. And the founders of that company used to work at Inc. And they didn't have an incubator to help them, but unless you think of Ames as a type of incubator, which in many cases Ames was. There's a lot of companies that, most of them not space companies, who spun out of, you know, doing research at Ames, and then they say, we're going to go start a company. And they developed their expertise on these issues. And while they worked at Ames, and they said, okay, it's time to go start a company. Skybox, another good example. Some ideas that came out of Stanford University and some classes there in innovation. And I guess if that's a type of incubator, Stanford University, then they went and started up a company and are now raised a lot of money. So I think Silicon Valley getting more focused on space is, in general, go to the core point, is a really exciting development. While I was in NASA headquarters, I thought that was critical. I actually came up with the idea that NASA should fund a $100,000 business prize, business plan competition prize, and NASA funded that for several years at the New Space Conference. Unfortunately, this last year it didn't happen. I think it was critical to mix it with something like a New Space Conference where there's a lot of people there, mix in the entrepreneurs with the NASA executives and the Silicon Valley people like Steve Jurvetson, who's been going there the last couple of years, and I hope they'll get it back there next year. And it was actually NASA's fault this year with the sequester. They didn't get the funding.
Yeah, well, it's going to be sometime in October near Stanford or at Stanford.
Yeah.
So.
But hopefully it'll go back to New Space, because I think there's just mixing all those different types of people, interesting things happen.
Yeah, it's a much stronger venue when it's with the New Space Conference, for sure.
Yep.
And I actually missed it not being there this year, so has to go back next year. But I think that's what they're focused on, and that is truly what's going to happen.
I'm fascinated. Last time I was on, David, that they had many more phone calls and than emails, and this year all the questions have been by email so far.
Tuesday night and Sunday are the big phone call days. On Monday afternoon and Friday morning, people are listening at work, and they're not allowed to use their phones to call in, but they let people listen with earphones at work. And so that's why I'm getting so many email messages. So the difference is the time of the show. And so even when there are people on the East Coast, they're well into commute going home unless they're working late or something like that. So they may or may not be listening live. They'll listen on their podcast later on.
Well, let me make a plug for somebody I think you should get on. Sarah Seeger, who's part of MIT, and I was wondering, actually, there was a Sarah from Boston earlier who asked a question. I think you really should get her on. She just won a MacArthur Fellowship. She's building a CubeSat, and she's also working with Planet Labs. I'd love to listen to Sarah.
What's her last name again?
Sarah Seeger, S-E-A-G-H-E-R. So, Sarah, if you're out there, you need to be on this show, too, if that was you from Boston who was asked the question.
Do you know her? Do you have her contact information?
I think I can get it.
If you send it to me, I will invite her very quickly to be on the show. So she's an undergrad.
That to me was the first commercial space MacArthur Fellowship, Sarah Seeger.
She has the first commercial space one.
Yes, well, that's what I'm saying. The first commercial space MacArthur Fellowship. Genius of Grant, right?
Right. Pretty damn cool. I have a lot of listeners at MIT and in that area, so...
Maybe one of your listeners will write you and say, Sarah, and I'll tell her she should be on.
I'm going to track her down, so thank you for that lead. I've been trying to get the guys from Skybox on, but they keep delaying for whatever reason. So one of these days they'll be on, because they raised almost $100 million. And
I think they've raised more than that.
They probably their initial round was in the $90 million. So
right, well, the prior round was if you add it up all up, it's more than 100, I think.
So that's quite a story for CubeSats or small nanosats. So I'm really anxious to get them on the show as well.
Well, they're like a refrigerator size sat. They're a small sat, not a CubeSat.
Small sat. Yeah, but they're. Yeah. They're doing great things, or at least their plan is to do great things. So I'm looking forward to that. For people wanting to break into the business, and we have a lot of students that listen, so I know there's enormous number of CubeSat student programs that are emerging and coming about, especially because they're easier to do and more affordable. But what is a good path for someone who wants to go in and start a commercial space company? Should they go work for a big company for a couple of years? What do you recommend? What do you see that works best?
Well, I don't know if working for a big company for a couple of years makes much sense unless they're getting their hands dirty, building real hardware and in a business that can do that. So I think there's a lot of excitement about getting involved in building real hardware with CubeSats at the university. If you can get in a university that's building CubeSats and building real hardware and getting it, flying it, and you get your hands dirty and get real experience flying hardware, I think then getting into a CubeSat business or starting your own, I think the main thing, other than building real hardware and building real CubeSats to do something that you need to figure out, is what is the business? What is the customer application of your CubeSat that makes sense? So you can build, a satellite that goes up in orbit and does, beeps at you or senses the environment and sends you back data. But that's what you do at the college level. You really need to be thinking about what is a customer willing to pay for and how are you going to deliver on that? And I see it, very few people really thinking about that compared to the number of people who are in it. So I think that's, college is not a bad time to be thinking about that and how are you going to put the pieces together for all, you know, that to deliver that service.
Good advice for these young students, and a lot of them listen to the show. So, and in fact, I got a note from someone who's moving to Los Angeles to be closer to the space community, and that came in last night, and he was picking my brain for advice on
elaborate on it. It doesn't have to be waiting till you go to college and get into a college program that does that, and you can go do your research and find out which colleges are doing it. And there's quite a few that the NSF is giving them money, and there's a lot of them launching. But you can now get into a high school and get real hardware experience building, spacecraft hardware at a high school. And one of the leading examples is Valley Christian Schools in the Bay Area has now put up 4 nano labs 4 years in a row. It's put a spacecraft in the International Space Station, and now they would love to, you know, put up a CubeSat, but they have now have a steady state where they're the leader of that was at New Space, and he talked about that the number one recruiting, the reason that students state for coming to their high school, which is a private high school, is because they get to build space hardware. And they know they're going to get to build space hardware because they do it, they've done it 4 years in a row each and every year. And so I asked this gentleman that was an input for as good as a school. What about an output measure that was good for the students? He said, well, this last year they had a young lady who was a leader on the team that sent hardware to the International Space Station via Nanorack, and she got a full-ride scholarship to MIT. And I just looked down and said, you know what, that's exactly, because she's probably going to be taking classes from professors who are teaching her about aerospace engineering, who have never built space hardware, and she has. And she has a big leg up on a lot of other aerospace engineers because she's already doing it and has real experience.
And she flew it. That's even better.
She flew it. And that's a real key discriminator for Nanorack, because you could build a program around your college or your high school, and flying in 9 months is critical. Contract assigning, you could have your payload in 9 months. We have 12 flights a year to the space station this year. We put payloads up on site. So that's once a month, highly reliable, dissimilar redundancy to many different launch vehicles. If you miss one flight, well, you got to wait a month or two. So it's you can build a real educational program around that for your college or university or your high school.
And Valley Christian is a private school in the area, and they have that space program. That's pretty interesting.
And they've got very entrepreneurial about it, too. I find it fascinating. So that it's Nanorack that sells these nanolabs, a 1U, to the International Space Station for $30,000, and Valley Christian raised that privately the first year. The second year, they got innovative on us. They subdivided the 1U into one-quarter U parts, and they sold off one-quarter U, subleased it to 3 other schools at $10,000 each. But so by the time they started, they had covered their cost. And then they had one-quarter U left over, and they did experiments in it. So they've been scaling this. They now, forget what the leader from the Valley Christian School said, is that they have like 16 or 20 or 24 schools involved. They're rapidly growing with all these schools who can, you know, they can go raise $10,000 and doing the PTA and local sponsors and bake sales. And that's doable, and a lot of schools are doing it.
I think they're in San Jose, California, right?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if it's Menlo Park or San Jose, or it's in the Silicon Valley area.
I need to get their director on the space show about that, too.
It would be great. Yeah, I think he'd be great to have on.
I just went to their website, so I'm going to take care of that after I get off the phone with you today. That would be a really interesting program. So there's a lot of things changing. When I started this program 12-plus years ago, there wasn't anything like this on the horizon, and the Constellation satellites, that were being talked about had all gone bust, like Teledesic and Iridium and the one in England, I forget what it was called, IEGO or something like that.
Yeah, Skybridge.
Yeah. So it is such a different world in just 12 years. It's unbelievable.
Yep.
It really has changed. And so do you think the change is going to be as fast and as dramatic? I mean, you did look 10 years out, but I consider this to be really a dramatic switch with the industry over the last 10 or 12 years. So while it's going to grow and expand, do you think it's going to be just totally different and new as well? I mean,
there's a lot of things the same, a lot of things are different. So for those who've been around a while, they get really disheartened by the, you know, that things aren't going faster. And I just, you know, if somebody's been doing this, you know, more than 25, getting close to 30 years, I point out to people there's been a pretty steady trend that the, you know, the long arc of history bends towards commercial space. And it never goes as fast as those who are the advocates would like it to go, but it's a very steady trend about more and more commercial methods, more and more commercial services over time. And there's lots of commercial ventures that, who died on the barbed wire trying to get over it, but other people have walked, you know, and tread on the ground that they trail, you know, that they trailblazed and are now succeeding, you know, and took, back in the 80s, you know, there was no such thing as a commercial launch service. You know, there was a national system that required that all commercial satellites be launched on it. It was a government-owned and operated system, and all satellites were launched on it, and all research was launched on it, and it's taken decades to break it away from that, and it took us 30 years of history. There was no FAA that you could go get a license to launch. That was created in 84. There was a Launch Service Purchase Act that was passed in 1990 that required NASA to buy commercial expendable launch services. In 86, they took commercial satellites off that government system, which is called SUTTL. It took a presidential decree to do it. And there was a very interesting story that at the last moment, the then NASA administrator tried to rewrite President Reagan's speech to say, we will study it rather than we will do it, take commercial satellites off. And I know the lady who was the then head of the FAA Office of Commercial Space Transportation, and she saw the NASA administrator doing it. And it's this fascinating story. She, as she related it to me, she said she saw this going on, that she knew that the interagency process had made the decision we were going to take commercial satellites off the shuttle. The speech had been written and saw the NASA administrator rewriting it. And like changing, like, we will shake it off to we will study taking it off, those types of things, and we're going to have Reagan get up and give that speech. And it would have been too late to take a bath and he's back if he'd done it in front of the public. And she saw that taking place, and she went to Nancy Reagan and told him her what was going on. And Nancy Reagan took the speech away from the NASA administrator and got it fixed. Now, there's this lady paid with it with her job, according to what she told me, because the NASA administrator was livid and went to the Secretary of Transportation and said, you know, this person who was basically well down in the bureaucracy from the secretary level had exceeded her authority. And but she did a great national service. So the Launch Service Purchase Act, a fascinating story, was the advocates who drafted the legislation with their local congressman, David Packard, and Colby from Arizona, Democrat and Republican, just did it because their constituents asked them to do it. They submitted the bill, the constituents had drafted it, and they thought most bills die after drafting. 98% of them are drafted, never go anywhere, and so they submitted it, and Ron Packer got a phone call from NASA in the, 88, saying, you can't do this. You cannot pass a law that says we'll buy commercial. And the fascinating part is Congressman Packard got pissed off. And he says, I'll show you. And so he made sure that law got passed because he got that phone call. So, and then in the 1998, we expanded that law, which became the Commercial Space Act of 1998 that required that not only do NASA buy commercial launch services, but they buy commercial space station cargo delivery services. Do it on firm fixed-price Part 12 commercial terms. NASA really didn't care at the time because they had the shuttle and they had big exclusions for using the shuttle, and they thought the shuttle would fly forever. So they let the law pass with that and didn't raise the fuss until the Columbia accident happened. And then we have they had the Commercial Crew and Cargo Program was created. And COTS and the ISS Commercial Resupply Service Program. So we've long arc of history, more and more commercial, now we have commercial crew, and that'll be the next thing where we do more and more commercial stuff on the space station, more applications take place, and we're getting cruiser that was passed and commercial suborbital RLVs. So I just think it's an exciting time. And there's a steady trend here, but for those in the middle of it, it often is a pass.
For sure. Any particular closing comments, or I mean, you just did a great closing statement, but specifically, anything you want listeners to take away specifically, or to remember, or to hold on to from today?
Oh gosh, I think this is a industry I just love. I think we're going to, that commercial space is the key to opening the space frontier. I think the next great focus, and I hope at some point we have a show on what DARPA is doing with the XS-1, which is that I think going to be the next, the DCX prime program, where we're going to refocus the nation on deep access to space. And that the whole purpose of this, of many of the people working in commercial space, including myself, is to expand human civilization across the solar system. It's I was hooked as a kid that humanity was going to spread across the solar system and someday start spreading to the stars. And I dedicated my life to that. And the method of how I can make a difference is help building the commercial industries that are going to make it happen. And I encourage those who want to dedicate their lives to great purpose and have a lot of fun doing it. And it's challenging. There are significant challenges that this would be a great place to do it.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more with you. Well, until the next time, Charles, and keep me posted. And when you have new updates for us, let us know, because I love talking commercial space with you. So it is the way of the future that so many of us have dreamed about and wanted to see happen, and it really is happening now.
Well, great. Thanks for having me, David.
Thank you. And listeners, back tomorrow with our regular Tuesday night schedule, and then Friday and Sunday, it's a regular week on the Space Show. And Bob Richards is the John Batchelor Hotel Mars guest on Wednesday night, 6:30 to 6:45 p.m. California time, for those of you that listen to the Hotel Mars segments. Thanks again to Charles Miller, and we will stay in touch on commercial space with you, Charles. And everyone have a great week. It's the beginning of the week. Keep it safe, have fun, and be productive. Goodbye from the Space Show and Charles Miller.